This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show here on BBS Radio. It's your host, Charles Giuliani. We're joined tonight by Juan Mendez. He's the special rapporteur on torture for the UN. And he's going to be speaking to us tonight about the Bradley Manning case. For those that aren't familiar with Bradley Manning, you know, the whole WikiLeaks thing and how he was illegally, unfairly detained. And before we get into, you know, the UN's condemnation of it, why don't you give us the a quick summation of the story of what lies behind Mr. Manning and what he actually revealed through WikiLeaks?
Mr. Manning is supposed to be the source of the hundreds of thousands of emails that WikiLeaks disclosed that were protected by confidentiality. They were, you know, internal State Department and Defense Department emails that had been accumulated over a series of years. He's accused of being the source, and he's accused of violating state secrets that he was supposed to protect because he had access to these materials in his capacity as a member of the U.S. Army. But the question of whether he should be tried or not, and under what circumstances, is not something that I, in my capacity as special rapporteur on torture, have had much to do with, because my mandate is about treatment, not about fair trial or whether somebody should be detained or not. But the problem is that the moment that he was arrested and before he was court-martialed, he was held first in Iraq, where he was stationed, and then in Quantico Marine Base here in the Washington area for a total of about 8 months, I believe, in a situation of detention that amounted to solitary confinement. And that's why I was asked by friends of his, I suppose, to inquire about his detention. And I did. The reason why the special rapporteurship on torture got involved, because my mandate is not only about physical torture, but also about the prohibition of any form of psychological torture as well. And solitary confinement, depending on the circumstances, obviously, but especially prolonged solitary confinement, falls well within my mandate and can constitute a form of psychological torture.
Yeah, it's absolutely disgraceful, and he's still being held to this day?
He's still being held, but not in solitary confinement. As a matter of fact, when I got involved as a special rapporteur, I sent a communication, as we call it, to the government of the United States, and then I held a couple of meetings at the State Department and at the Pentagon. And the Defense Department never admitted that there was anything wrong in the way he was being treated, but more or less in April of 2011, he was transferred from Quantico base to an army base in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And when he arrived in Fort Leavenworth, he was placed in a different kind of detention. So he's no longer, I mean, as of April of 2011, so it's 2 years now, he is held and he's court-martialed, but he's not in solitary confinement. And I know this because his lawyer, who has been in touch with me, and I have agreed that if his conditions of detention change in any way for the worse, that he will let me know and ask me to intervene again. And he hasn't in these 2 years.
Now, obviously, you know, this violates United States constitutional law, but of course they're probably overriding that fictitiously, you know, whatever, through what, the Patriot Act or something? Is that how they're getting around U.S. constitutional law?
No. He's being court-martialed. So he's being tried as a member of the military for violation of his duty of confidentiality, of secrecy.
So like treason?
I'm sorry?
Sort of like treason.
Yeah, I don't think the accusation is treason, but it is, I think it's something like sharing information with the enemy. What's interesting here is that he gave it to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks is not a combat force that is in any kind of war with the United States. So it seems like a little far-fetched. He may have violated secrets, and he may have violated military discipline, but either treason or aiding and abetting the enemy doesn't seem to me to be a valid charge in this case. But again, my competence as the Special Rapporteur on Torture does not deal with the charges or the nature of the charges or even with the procedure under which he's being tried. You know, courts-martial do not offer the same kind of guarantees to a defendant as in regular criminal trials. But again, I have not looked into whether he's getting a fair trial or not, because that is outside my mandate.
Right, right. It's not your jurisdiction or whatever. What laws, though, specifically as far as international law, is the UN, you know, claiming that's being violated here? Just the, I mean,
well,
they are calling
it. Yeah, the United States is a party to a convention called the Convention Against Torture. It's a treaty that has been in existence since the 80s, and it was signed and ratified during President Reagan's term, and the treaty defines torture as any kind of pain and suffering, either physical or mental. That crosses a certain degree of severity, and that it is done with either with the purpose of interrogation or of punishment, or in any other way. Now, in my inquiry, I asked what was the purpose and the reason for putting him in solitary confinement. And the Pentagon answered, well, this is in relation with the severity of the crime that he's been accused of. And so I asked, well, but if he hasn't been found guilty of that crime yet, what is the rationale? Then they said that they were putting him in that kind of regimen for his own protection. And they said that for privacy reasons, they couldn't tell me, what kind of danger he was supposed to be
that he was being protected from. Yeah, what nonsense. Yeah.
They didn't say it was suicide watch, but they did call it prevention of harm watch. But they didn't really explain where the harm could come from.
Yeah.
They kind of hinted towards some sense of, keeping a close eye on him because of his own, possibility of hurting himself. Now, It seems to me like solitary confinement, because you have to. He was held for 22 or 23 hours every day by himself, looking at a wall, and then being carried for the rest of the other, for the 1 hour a day, to a place to exercise, quote unquote, just by himself and in the presence of guards, and you know, taking back and forth in chains and all that. It seems to me like if he did have any kind of psychological problems, they were probably exacerbated by this kind of treatment. So I concluded, and I published this, that the justifications offered to me were not valid, that the United States was indeed violating his rights and violating the United States' obligation not to cause harm, not to cause pain and suffering, in this case of a psychological nature, of a mental nature, and that that should cease.
Absolutely incredible. So from the time that this ordeal began until now, how much time has actually transpired?
Well, I think he's now been held for about 3 years. And as I said, the first 8 months in solitary confinement, in my mind, without any justification whatsoever, it seems to me that they were probably putting pressure on him to plead guilty or to turn state's evidence against others. But that's speculation. I just don't know. Either way, if that is the rationale, of course, that's also illegitimate. That cannot be done. But as you know, about a year ago, his court-martial has started. I think he has pleaded guilty to some offenses, and he's being tried on some other ones. And I just don't know what the outcome is going to be. What I do know is that he's no longer held in solitary confinement, and that he sees other inmates, and he sees family and friends and lawyers, etc., on a regular basis. And if his mode of incarceration changes for the worse, I have asked to be told about it so that I can do something about it as well.
And, of course, during all of this time, there has been no trial whatsoever and no formal charge of anything still.
No. He has been charged. About a year ago, the trial itself before a court-martial did start.
Oh, okay.
As I said, in the context of that, I understand that he has pleaded guilty to some offenses, but he's still defending from some other charges. As far as I know, the court-martial has not ended, but it has started. He's been coming to hearings somewhere at a court-martial here in the Washington area. And I don't know when was the last time that he had a hearing, but he has had some already.
But still not officially...
not convicted yet, no.
Convicted, and yet all this time he's being held. Yeah. Exactly. I mean... Even aside from the solitary, that's mental torture.
Well, I mean, I can't comment on whether he has committed any kind of crime or not. That again is not part of my mandate as a special rapporteur on torture. There are other special rapporteurs or working groups that can deal with that, the working group on arbitrary detention and the special rapporteur on independence of courts of the judiciary will probably comment on that eventually as well. When all is said and done, you know, not in my capacity as special rapporteur, but as a citizen or as an expert in human rights, I will have to consider whether any crime has been proven to have been committed, and if so, whether the penalty is proportionate to it. He was indeed subject to the military discipline and the obligation not to disclose certain secrets. Now, whether what he disclosed was something that he should not have disclosed or not is something that we'll have to look at the end of the trial.
Right. Boy, what a mess. What a incredible miscarriage of justice. I'm just curious, have you personally dealt with any prisoners, you know, at Guantanamo or any of the other, you know, Eastern European or Northern, Moroccan, CIA victims of torture?
Yeah, unfortunately, I deal with many other cases like that. First, I have, you know, jurisdiction of some sort over all 194 countries in the world. All members of the United Nations, I have a mandate to inquire about cases of torture or ill treatment of any sort. Second, yes, I get many different kinds of cases from different parts of the world, some very brutal physical torture, some mostly mental, some having to do with just common crime, supposedly law enforcement kind of issues, some having to do with the war against terrorism. Within the United States, I've dealt with Guantanamo and with individuals in Guantanamo. I've dealt with many individuals who are were never taken to Guantanamo, but are brought directly into the U.S. territory for trial in federal courts and are then sent to different prisons, federal prisons like ADX in Colorado. And I get complaints about their treatment, and I inquire into them, and I engage with the United States government on the conditions of detention. Again, not on whether they should be tried or not, because that's not part of my mandate, but if the conditions of detention are alleged to breach the obligations of the United States under the Convention Against Torture, I get involved.
Have you ever had any success in any of these cases?
I think the Bradley Manning case is kind of a partial success because, as I said, and I don't claim that it happened only because of my intervention, because there were many pressures on the United States at the time, even with demonstrations before, you know, at the gates of the Quantico Marine Base here, for example, by common men and women who thought this was an outrage. But as I was saying, after the initial 8 months, his condition of detention was changed into something different from solitary confinement. As to others, unfortunately, it's a lot harder to claim success. I think we have a little more luck with situations in which we are asking governments not to deport somebody to a place where he or she could be tortured. For example, several Northern European countries have, at our insistence, stopped deportation of some people who were going to be sent to places where they could be tortured. I think when I visit countries like I did with Morocco last fall, I think conditions for some inmates at least certainly improved in anticipation of my visit and hopefully a little beyond my visit as well. In terms of eradicating torture altogether, I wish I could be a little more optimistic, but I have learned to have a long-term view here, and it will be a matter of continuing to press. But it's difficult to claim larger victories in this field.
Yeah, it's so disgusting when you see this being done by the U.S. Because traditionally, at least on the surface, anyway, this government has been openly opposed to human rights abuses of this type. Of course, the reality is, as I'm sure you're aware, they were still doing it more clandestinely, but now they're doing it right out in the open under the color of law. And, this is not a step forward, of course.
Well, it's also true the situation changes from time to time. And, for example, the prohibition by President Obama the day after he took office in 2009 at least seems to have had an effect with respect to extraordinary renditions and the use of black sides. Even at that time, I always said that that wasn't enough, that just turning the page and saying we'll ignore what happened until now is also a violation of an obligation. The Convention Against Torture says very clearly that states have an obligation to investigate, prosecute, and punish every act of torture. So there's the unfortunately, the Obama administration has not, in fact, has steadfastly objected to investigating the cases of torture that had happened, before its time. And obviously, I'm not saying that not a single case of torture has happened since 2009, because we just don't know. There's so much secrecy surrounding it. What looks pretty clear is that extraordinary renditions, and taking people to black sites is no longer part of the picture. But in contrast, for example, the situation in Guantanamo that started improving, at least there were promises of shutting it down, and there were reduction of the numbers held there. Unfortunately, now it has taken a turn for the worse, and I think the U.S. government has a real crisis in its hands with a hunger strike that is being carried out by people who have been sometimes, 10 years there, and they have been cleared for release. The government acknowledges that they have nothing against them, that they cannot link them in any way to terrorism, and they still keep them there. So in a recent press release, I said that that in itself was cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and therefore part of my mandate as well.
What possible justification are they giving for continuing to detain them after they've admitted they haven't found any guilt?
Well, if you heard President Obama last week, first of all, he blamed Congress, because Congress indeed, in several different pieces of legislation, has made it difficult to transfer those detainees anywhere, either to the mainland to be tried or to be released to any other country. But the administration has always had some kind of waiver within those pieces of legislation, and the administration could have, without any change in law, could have released at least those who have been cleared now for many years for release. The Uyghurs, for example, from China, the Yemenis, etc. Now, another reason was that given the unstable situation in Yemen, the United States didn't want to release anybody there because they might join Al-Qaeda. So if they weren't terrorists before, they were going to be terrorists now. But that also has to do with, the injustice committed against them. So it seems to me like a vicious circle. You didn't have any reason to hold them, but now you do. And the reason is something, wholly created by the U.S. government. So
however, the situation in Yemen
has stabilized. And so hopefully, after the speech by President Obama, there is some possibility that things may start to improve.
Let me ask your opinion on this. There's been many instances. In fact, the BBC has done several documentaries on this over the past decade or so, since the quote war on terror began, and the torture fiascos, El Gharib in Iraq and Guantanamo and so forth. And what they revealed in some of their investigations, and subsequent investigations have even elaborated on this even further, but what has come out is that in a lot of these instances, maybe all of them, it turns out that the CIA has been torturing people in some of these prisons simply to get them to make a false confession. They actually hand them a piece of paper and tell them to read off of it, to give the illusion that they're actually capturing real terrorists. And do you think that this is going on across the board all the time, or is this an isolated incident? In other words, is this whole torture thing a complete fraud? That's certainly the impression you would get, you know, from watching some of these BBC documentaries.
Well, there's been so many cases over almost now 12 years that it's difficult to generalize. I mean, first of all, I think the reason to combat terrorism was and maybe still is real. You know, there's no question that after 2001, the United States faced a serious problem with the possibility of attacks on the civilian population of the United States. The problem is, you know, that the fact that you have a security challenge doesn't mean that all bets are off and that you can't and that you can therefore ignore your obligations under international human rights law. I think that has been not only an illegal action, but also a very serious mistake, because it has, you know, just created this situation in which the United States is not trusted by anybody outside of the United States. It has created tensions with allies of the United States everywhere, and it has, you know, generated a whole new generation of young people who feel so alienated and so insulted by the United States that they are easy fodder for terrorism. So I think the policies of the war against terror, including the torture memos and the actual torture that did happen, has, you know, been very counterproductive to the security interests of the United States, in addition to being illegal and immoral.
Right.
Now, whether they tortured only people who were known to be terrorists, or they tortured a lot of innocent people, that's difficult to say. But what I would say as a matter of law is that even if they tortured the worst kind of terrorist, it's still illegal, it's still immoral, it's still counterproductive.
Yeah. Sure. Either way, it's got to stop.
Yeah, and I think we have a chance to stop it. I think it's going to be stopped little by little, issue by issue. But I am not pessimistic. I don't expect to get rid of all the problems of torture in the world, even within my term as a special rapporteur. But I do think, and I've always thought, that just like slavery in its time, torture is something that we can abolish, and we should be able to abolish, not only because it's recognized everywhere to be wrong and immoral and illegal, but also because it is possible for common men and women to unite behind the need to put a stop to it.
Yeah, we're definitely taking a step backwards, not forward, with this. The West pretty much had, made it illegal, and at least on the surface, you know, was following that policy up until recently. And now, we've taken this. And what kind of example is this setting? Or better yet, what kind of danger are we exposing our own soldiers to? If we're going to torture others, then naturally others are going to torture our soldiers. They're going to be subject to that type of thing. How can we legitimately tell another country not to torture if we're doing it?
That's exactly right. When it comes to the laws of war, one important justification for the restraints put by the law on what can be done to the enemy and to civilian population is precisely that. The reciprocity principle, you know, if we expect our soldiers to be treated decently when they fall into the hands of the enemy, then we have to do it ourselves as well. And that has been part of a tradition that the United States has been a proud part of, that tradition for literally decades and even generations. And I tend to think that the war on terror, the last 10 years, 12 years, is kind of a backward trend, but not a definitive one, not one that, you know, kind of erases all that tradition.
Sure.
I think it you know, positive change is well within the reach, and you know, we just need to keep plugging at it.
Absolutely. I tell you what, we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be taking some questions here and maybe some calls as well. So stick with us, folks. We'll be right back.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson for Normal. And like millions of other responsible Americans, I smoke pot. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana. And it's none of the government's business. Let's get the government out of our private lives once and for all and stop arresting smokers. Let's take a stand for personal freedom. To learn how you can help, go to normal.org.
Come, you masters of war.
Hello, this is Cindy Sheehan. America's war on terror has become a war of terror, with endless drone bombings, continuing military occupation, as well as detention, rendition, and torture still being practiced under the current administration. I lost my precious son Casey to war, and now work towards a day when not one more mother, son, or daughter will suffer such a loss. Listen to my podcast, read my blog, and come join me at any activities I attend near you. Please visit CindySheehanSoapbox.com for more information, and let's work for peace together.
Build, destroy.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests from various realms of interest share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. Once again, we're joined, for those that weren't with us the first hour, we're joined today by Juan Mendez. He's the special rapporteur on torture for the UN, and he's here speaking to us about the Bradley Manning case, the WikiLeaks victim of being held, for basically 3 years now, first in solitary confinement, and now still being held. The trial has been dragging on, and it's just, one excruciating ordeal for Manning. And the UN has now officially declared this torture, and it is. It's mental torture to hold someone like this such a long time and not formally. For the longest time, they hadn't charged him with anything. Now they've charged him, but there's still no sentence forthcoming. It's just dragging on. In the meantime, 3 years of his life have been wasted. It's just incredible. But, of course, you've also been talking about even worse things, physical torture that has been going on as well, in the name of this quote, war on terror. I prefer to call it war of terror. It doesn't seem to be a war on terror when they're engaging in, terror themselves.
sometimes that kind of tactic is called state terrorism.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go so far as to say that the United States has engaged in state terrorism, as, for example, the military regimes of the Southern Cone under Pinochet and under Videla did when they, literally disappeared and clandestinely killed literally thousands of people and after torturing them. But torture is an international crime just the same.
Well, interestingly enough, the United States put Pinochet in power.
I'm sorry?
The United States put Pinochet in power.
Well, yes. excuse me. the United States may have been complicit in what Pinochet did, at least for upholding him at first and turning its back on him later on. But what I'm saying is that what the kind of regime that we call state terrorism, is quite a bit more brutal and more massive in its atrocities than whatever the United States has done. And that's not to
minimize
the seriousness of what has happened in the war on terror in the last 10 years. It's just to, keep a little perspective. Nevertheless, torture is torture, and for example, in terms of the extraordinary renditions, they look very much like forced disappearances, but with an important difference. As far as we know, all the cases that have been reported of enforced disappearances, of extraordinary rendition, the people the victims are known to have survived them. There hasn't been, as far as I can tell, at least any case of clandestine killing and disposal of the body. Whereas in forced disappearances, the end result in the majority of the cases, I would say in a high percentage of the cases, 90% of the cases, was precisely the disposal of the victim by clandestine burial, by throwing them off planes into the sea, etc. So, again, that's not to say that extraordinary renditions are kind of a minor form of violation. They're very serious, very, astonishingly immoral and illegal, and yet the United States engaged in it with the complicity of something like 54 other countries, according to one of the most recent reports that have been published about it.
Incredible. Disgusting. Have you yourself ever been allowed access into any part of the Guantanamo facility?
No, I've asked to visit it. In fact, my predecessor in this position, a European jurist called Manfred Novak, had asked to see Guantanamo way back in 2004, and the Bush administration actually did invite him and three other rapporteurs, but on conditions that he could not accept. So when I became the special rapporteur in 2011, and noting, of course, that the situation had changed and that President Obama had promised to close down Guantanamo, I asked to visit Guantanamo again, and I told the government of the United States that if they're going to give me the same terms as they had offered Manfred Novak, then I was not going to be able to accept those terms. And indeed, they did give me the very same terms, which consist of, being given a guided tour and being able to talk to the authorities, but not seeing every part of the Guantanamo facility, and specifically not being allowed to speak either in private or in the presence of others with any inmate there. So obviously, under those conditions, I cannot accept, because if I accept that from the United States, every other government is going to claim the same right to give me guided tours of their prisons. And my mandate says very clearly that I should be allowed to visit every facility of my choosing at any time and hour of the day of my choosing. Being able to see every part of the facility, open every door wherever I want to go, and very specifically being able to see inmates of my choosing and without the presence of guards. Every country I visited, I do that. It's a difficult negotiation, but I have visited prisons in many countries, and in all of them, those conditions are there. So I cannot allow any exception for Guantanamo.
Which makes me wonder, Juan, is the United States better than regimes like Pinochet, if they are hiding things, and clearly they are, that's why they aren't allowing you full access, telling you you can only visit unless you have limited access, they have something to hide. So, you know, is it better what they're doing than Pinochet did? Maybe it's worse.
You know, I don't know.
Use
any kind of ranking. I don't qualify. I don't compare one country to another. I compare them to their own records and to the international standards that I uphold for every country the same.
Yeah.
The United States doesn't allow me to visit Guantanamo. China does not allow me to visit prisons there. Russia doesn't allow me to visit prisons there. Iran doesn't even answer my phone calls. There are other countries that do have serious problems with torture that do allow me to visit. Morocco and Western Sahara, for example, Tunisia, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uruguay, those are countries that I have visited. And in all cases, I think the visit has been an occasion at least for some improvement. But of course, you have to have the goodwill to recognize that you have problems and be willing to change and to improve. And then the visit by the special rapporteur is an occasion to improve. Unfortunately, if you don't want to recognize that you have a problem with torture or ill treatment of any sort, it's going to be very difficult to help.
Right. Let's go to some questions. Time is running away on us here. This first one is from Mike in California, and he asks, can the U.S. be held accountable for not complying with your request for meeting with Bradley Manning and for his mistreatment? And if so, by what means can this accountability be enforced? Or, you know, is it a case of the USA can do what it wants, including ignoring UN rules of treatment, you know, of prisoners, because it can't?
Well, you know, my mandate, you know, and my resolutions, my decisions on cases are unfortunately not binding. That's a kind of the rules of the game. I do publish them. They are a form of accountability, a weak form of accountability, if you ask me, but it is something that people sometimes find useful. And that's why Bradley Manning's lawyer asked me to engage in this exchange of notes and of interviews about his case. But in other terms, the United States is a party to the Convention Against Torture, so every 4 years, I believe, it has to come before the Committee Against Torture, which is a treaty body, and explain and answer questions about what it's doing. Again, that's a little better, a little more formal form of accountability, but it's not something that can be enforced very easily. The United States does not accept the jurisdiction of any external court, like the Inter-American Court on Human Rights, or even of the Committee Against Torture for individual cases that can be, the final decision on them can be binding on countries. Unfortunately, the United States does not want to be a part. You can only be held accountable voluntarily, if you will. Then the final way of holding individuals, but not states, accountable would be to be brought before the International Criminal Court. But the United States is also not a party to that body. And so Americans can be brought before the ICC only if they commit crimes under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court in countries that are parties to the International Criminal Court, like Afghanistan, for example. But so far, there are no cases against Americans before the International Criminal Court.
We have another question from Kim, somewhere in the U.S. She asks, what's wrong with voting for the lesser of two evils? I'm not sure exactly what she's referring to there.
voting for the lesser of two evils. I don't know what he went.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the context of that question is. It just came in that form. Maybe she's referring to torture as a viable means of
obtaining information.
Yeah, I'm guessing.
Well, the first answer to that is, you know, that it's illegal. I mean, under the Convention Against Torture that the United States has signed and ratified, and let me say again, it was done in Republican administrations, so even conservative thinkers in this country never thought of filing any reservation to the absolute prohibition on torture, and not only on torture, on cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, that is a lesser form, a less serious form of mistreatment. In both cases, the prohibition is absolute, and specifically that no situation of emergency, no special circumstances allow a state to depart from that obligation.
No exceptions.
That may sound
legalistic,
but I actually think, as a former victim of torture myself, that the reason the law is so absolute on this is that torture demeans not only the victim of torture, but also the state officials that are asked to commit them, that it just makes us all less human. And those of us who think that it's okay to allow it in our name because it makes us feel more secure, that we think we are safer because someone in our name tortures, we're under an illusion. It's not true. There's no relationship between our safety and the breach of this, moral and legal obligation not to commit any atrocity against the dignity of another human being. In fact, if anything, the opposite is true. The more we torture, the more that we lose the moral high ground, and the more that we generate the conditions under which torture, flourishes around the world and happens then against us as well. So I think there's really no justification for torture under any circumstance, and attempts to justify it under some kind of ticking bomb scenario are also misguided, because that's not the way torture happens. You don't save lives by torturing anybody. What you do is create conditions in which more lives are lost.
Sure, sure. You're actually encouraging, the enemy to worsen to lower the standards.
Exactly, and to feel justified.
Sure. It actually encourages more terrorism. Sure.
In committing new terrorist acts.
Yeah. Anyway, one final question, and then we'll have to wrap up here. Time has run out on us. This is from Lawrence in Ohio, and he asks, if torture is inhumane, isn't the act of war also inhumane, since it always opens the door to abuses, murder, and torture?
Well, I think we would all like to see war eradicated. Nobody is in favor of war. But it's also true that war can and should be fought with restraint and with laws and customs of war that have existed now for generations and centuries even, and that tend to humanize armed conflict. The Geneva Conventions very explicitly prohibit any form of mistreatment or any the language is outrages against the personal dignity of detainees. And the United States has signed and ratified them and, has made it part of its law. The Uniform Code of Military Justice prohibits any form of coercion over an enemy soldier that has been captured. And it has always been like that. In fact, when the Bush administration tried to justify mistreatment of al-Qaeda captives, they tried first to say, well, they were not really combatants, there's something else. Now, that also flies in the face of the absolute prohibition on torture that I mentioned before.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. Anyway, we have run out of time. I want to thank you, though, for taking time out and coming to discuss this with us. And good luck on the Manning case. What's the next move, or do you, in fact, even know?
Well, I'm just sitting and waiting. I mean, I'm not taking any active role in the Manning case right now because, as I said, I'm just on call if necessary. But and we keep our fingers crossed, his treatment in custody has not taken a turn for the worse. If it does, I'll have to do something about it. Yeah.
What type of measures do you have available, or are you able to discuss that?
Well, the same that I did originally. I mean, I write a note to the government, like I do to other governments in other cases. That note is confidential for, it can be urgent if it's an urgent matter, or the government has 60 days to respond. And then at the end, depending on what the answer is, or if there is no answer, I issue my views on whether the state has violated an obligation under international law, and I publish it. And at that point, of course, it becomes public, and it's reported to the Human Rights Council of the United Nations. Now, that sometimes is a form of pressure on states to do the right thing, but there are states, of course, that can shrug off that kind of pressure as well, you know. I think in the end, it all depends on how much the citizens of a country are willing to use this kind of methodology to speak truth to power and tell the state that it has to mend its ways. It's really more up to what uses can be made of what we do than the immediate results of what we do.
Okay, thanks again for joining us, and good luck. Maybe we can have you on again sometime to give us an update. Hopefully, it'll be a good update.
Yeah, okay, anytime. Of course, I'll be ready to answer your questions.
Excellent. Thanks again. Thanks again for joining us. Really appreciate it. Okay, folks, we're out of time for this week. Join us next week. We're going to be interviewing Dr. William Pepper. He's the attorney for Sirhan Sirhan, the alleged, and I do mean alleged, assassin of RFK. Pepper's contention is, and ever has been, that he was framed for this murder. And he'll be presenting some powerful evidence to prove that point next week. So you don't want to miss that. We'll see you then, folks. Have a great week. Take care.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.